welcome to your new life and our new times in what has been labeled as humanity's greatest leap in evolution. Dr. K is here to assist you with holistic tips and tools, clearings and activations for your vibrational upgrade. Dr. Allison J. K. has been working as an energy medicine practitioner for 20 years, having lived in Asia for 10 years to study subtle energy. People refer to Dr. K as the lightning bolt due to the high voltage of the work she does on behalf of assisting you to thrive in mind, body, and spirit. That is the greatest backdrop to life on planet Earth right now.
Thanks for coming and joining in, taking time out of your day, whether it's live or the recorded version for this special radio show. I feel so honored by this being who is with us today, Sir Krishna Das. I'm putting a sir in front of it. I don't know how he feels about that.
Well, the queen also didn't like that.
Yeah? You want to be Queen Das?
The Queen of England. I'm a sir. You and Mick Jagger.
Yeah, you were Mick Jagger. What was it like singing with Sting, by the way?
Oh, it was wonderful. He's such a great guy.
He was a total fan of yours, right? And he actually, didn't he ask you if he could sing with you?
Well, yeah, the people from, my friends from Jiva Mukti gave him my first CD, and he'd been doing his yoga practice to it for over a year.
Oh, really?
And then he invited us to come to his place in Italy and do like a week-long retreat, which we did. It was great. He's a really good guy, you know. The media is so crazy, but they don't really understand people. They don't, you know, they just want to give you all the weird stuff. But he's a wonderful person, caring person, and he bought this estate.
Wow.
In Florence, in where is it? I forget. But and it was a huge estate, and he bought the house and the main and the lands and everything. And right after he fixed up the place a little bit, he invited all the local townspeople who lived around the estate to come for a big meal.
Oh my God, now, how cool.
Their parents, their grandparents, their great grandparents, and on had worked for the lord of this estate for their whole lives, and they had never been into the main house.
Sweet thing.
In hundreds of years. And so these people came, and they were just completely blown away because they'd heard about this, you know, they'd never been invited into the house by the previous owners, the family of this great estate. So Sting invited everybody in, made a big meal. It was wonderful.
He's one of my favorite voices on the planet.
Yeah, he's great.
You're one of my favorite hearts on the planet.
Oh, thank you.
Which comes through your voice, which is the... I love the description of that your voice is like gravity. You hear it, you guys? You should be... Okay.
I know what that means, yeah.
Yeah. You want to... So who we have, for those of you who don't know, with us today, and Krishna Das, feel free, obviously, to correct anything that I say that makes you cringe or is inaccurate. Speaking of inaccuracies, I want to correct something. I put out there in the blurb for today's show that Krishna Das went to the same guru as the Beatles in that first wave of Westerns going into India in the 1970s, and that's inaccurate. It's Neem Karoli Baba, or fondly and lovingly known as Maharaji, and I want KD obviously to say his name because it's beautiful. You can hear the love when KD says his guru's name. That's who Ram Das, Krishna Das's first teacher, introduced him to in India, but it's not the same as who George Harrison, John Lennon, Paul McCartney, and Ringo Starr went to. They went to Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. And it's a little bit difficult to keep some of them sorted. I know that even with my living in Asia and studying in India for my yoga teacher training, I still have difficulty apparently because I didn't get it right.
Well, Maharaji Maharishi is pretty close, really.
What Maharaji, when I saw you in Orlando, you communicated, and it's done in a lot of your interviews, it's done in a lot of what I see you talk about over and over again. The most pressing impression was the unconditional love of Maharaji.
That's something we don't get in the West. You know, we don't grow up with unconditional love, and we don't understand that that's what we're all looking for, and that's what we need to find in order to really be at ease and at peace and happy in our own hearts. So it's only when you run into somebody like that, a great being who has become love, that you actually get a taste of what unconditional love is. It's as if it's a room that we get allowed to come into. It's not something that you get from the outside. It's just all of a sudden you're in this room. The whole world becomes filled with that love. And you recognize this is home.
Yeah.
You know, that's the most amazing thing, that this is, you recognize, this is the way it really should be all the time. But then your stuff pulls you right out, throws you out on the street, you know. So you have to find your way back in over and over again.
Over and over again. Yeah, you talk about the journey. You talk about it in your book that came out in, what was it, in 2010?
I think so, yeah.
Chance of a Lifetime. You talk about stories with your Guru Maharaji. And do you go into your own, isn't there some biographical stuff in there too about what
led you? Yeah, sure. Yeah, definitely. I share with people a lot of the stuff that I went through after he sent me back to America, and then he died. He left the body, and I went through terrible years of despair and unhappiness before I began to look for a way back into that room.
What led you back into the room?
Chanting. I was standing in my room in New York. So must have been in the mid-90s, or maybe around 94. And this is 21 years after Maharaji died. And I was not in good shape. I was not doing well. I was not happy, and my life seemed to be unraveling, and yet again. And as I was standing in the living room, I was struck with this epiphany and this like lightning, like a lightning bolt, that if I did not start chanting with people who didn't know me from the old days. I mean, I was singing a little bit, but not much, but only with people that I had shared that with back in the old days in India. But if I did not start singing with people, then I would never be able to clean out the dark corners of my own heart. It was the only way I had. It was very clear. It was, you know, there was no doubt about it.
Pilgrim Heart before or after that?
What's that?
Is Pilgrim Heart before or after that?
Oh, everything's after that. I hadn't even begun chanting yet. You know, this is One Track Heart was the first one that came out, I think, in late 95.
Okay.
And this is before that. This is probably 94. So I really had to force myself to start singing and singing with people.
Go ahead.
No, for me, there was no access to that inner place without singing with people.
It's so rich. I want to come back to that. I'd like to actually back up, because wasn't your first, what was it about Ram Dass back in 69?
Met Ram Dass actually, in the winter of 68, 69, probably January 69. Mm-hmm. Well, I walked into the room where he was sitting. I heard about this guy who had been in India, and so I went up to see him, and I walked into the room, and the minute I walked into the room, I knew that whatever it was I was looking for, and I wouldn't have known what to call it at that point, really, but whatever it was, and I was looking for something, it was real. It existed in the world, You could find it. It was real. And that was the first time I ever felt that. And it was a very, it was life-changing, really. Not like all the lights went on immediately, but it was the beginning of being on the path.
What's the word you would call it now, KD?
Life-changing.
Sweet. So Ram Dass, just for a brief explanation, is, his real name is David, what's his last name?
Richard Alpert.
Okay. And Richard Alpert, yeah. So I was wrong that it's not David Richard Alpert, it's just Richard Alpert?
I don't think it's David, no.
You would know better. Richard Alpert. Okay. And so he was a Harvard professor, right, who was part of the Timothy Leary dropout?
Yeah, Timothy Leary was in the, they were in the psychology department, and Tim was, I think, senior to him, and his office was next door. And Tim discovered psychedelic drugs, and he thought it would be a good tool to unlock, you know, some of the places in people psychologically, and they started to test it and experiment with it to see how it could be used in psychological therapy. But they quickly got...
Is it Harvard? You guys, Harvard University.
Harvard University. Well, they got so far out that Harvard threw them right out.
And then they went to India, right?
Well, Ram Dass went to India, yeah. Finally, Richard Alpert went to India because he wanted to find out what this was. You know, obviously this LSD had changed his life and opened him up to things that he had never imagined, but he still didn't know what it was. So he took a bunch of it and he went to India and he gave it to people who wanted to try it. And everybody liked it and, you know, but nobody, everybody had deep experiences and wanted more, but nobody could tell him what it was. And he was then finally, through a series of events, he came to meet Neem Karoli Baba. And he had a very deep experience with him on the first day that he met him, also life-changing, where Maharaji, his heart just opened and he cried like a baby and he felt that he was home, and it was a whole extraordinary experience. But anyway, the next day, he came back to see Maharaji, and Maharaji said, do you have any medicine? And Ram Dass thought he meant like aspirin or something, right? So he takes out some aspirin. He says, no. The yogi medicine. So he must be talking about acid. So he takes out some acid. He has like four or five very powerful pills of pure acid. And he holds it out in front of Maharaji. Maharaji takes all five and throws them in his mouth.
Jesus.
And Ram Dass freaked, you know. He said he just took enough to kill a horse. And he sat around with him all day, and there was no change in Maharaji. No change, nothing. He was exactly the same, funny, playful, sweet, laughing, talking to people. There was no change at all.
Well, some of you listeners may have dropped off in horrification at the mention of LSD, but I just want to contextualize it. Back in the 60s and in the 70s, that was used as a vehicle for opening to higher planes and different ways of being in the world. And it was kind of, I'm going to let KD take over to complete the story. And so just understand that there's a higher context we're talking about this and in a bigger purpose why it's being brought up.
So let's just go back. So Ram Dass sat around all day with Maharaji, and nothing happened to him after taking all that LSD. And the idea, of course, was the reason Maharaji did that was to show that the real state of being, the real God state, is beyond any drug or any chemical. And that's why he did that. And he himself never took drugs or any kind of anything like that. It was a totally different situation. But Ram Dass was attached to it, so he wanted to show him that what it was and what it wasn't, you know. And in fact, later on, he said, you know, that LSD can bring you into the room with Christ, but you can't stay. The only way to stay is love. And he didn't, he totally didn't, you know, encourage us to cultivate that love in our hearts. And he never discouraged us, always discouraged us from being interested in drugs in any way.
Well, it's escape. He wanted authentic connection with one's higher self and with it all.
I mean, absolutely.
That's the whole path.
And so really he did that for Ram Dass, who was, you know, involved with LSD and was attached to it. And he showed him what it was and what it wasn't, and that it was all possible without that. So he was, it was very specific. See, Maharaji, he didn't give formal teachings for broad audiences, you know. He worked with each individual, and within the flow of each individual's life, he shows us the best way to go for each person. And that was necessary for Ram Dass at that point.
So Ram Dass came back. Did he write Be Here Now before you met him? Had he already
No, that was Be Here Now came out of lectures that he gave from starting around the time that I met him until sometime after that. Yeah. In fact, I was sitting with Maharaji and Ram Dass in India when Ram Dass brought the first copy of Be Here Now.
Oh.
So that was nice, yeah.
And now you have next weekend, you have a tribute to Ram Dass, who, Ram Dass is now a major friend with Wayne Dwyer as well. They both live in Hawaii, right?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, and so I know that you also have, you can go to Krishna Dass, or krishnadassmusic.com, and you can see in the CDs in store, there's a DVD available where both Krishna Dass and Ram Dass are together talking in. The title is Open Your Heart in Paradise. Next weekend, though, KD is in D.C. and Virginia with a tribute. It's the Buddha Fest, but then
it's called Buddha Fest. Yeah, there's a lot of wonderful Buddhist teachers there and lamas. And but the organizers wanted to honor Ram Dass for his role in bringing an awareness to the path, you know, the spiritual path.
And that's so all there. That's ultimately what you're both doing. I mean, that's what kirtan is. I loved your story about how you talked about kirtan opening up for you. I mean, you just talked about something I didn't know about being in the living room and realizing you needed to be with people singing. But I know you seemed like, so when you met Ram Dass, you were searching, as you say, and then you go to India and then you come back. And there's something that you talk about with self-acceptance and about the love held so much for you that Maharaji emanated, and it rocked your world, man. I mean, your whole life, still to this day, this one being. I have some awe in that one person can just strike through you. Because I mean, you were born Jewish, you were born a New York Long Island Jew boy who was interested in rock music, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but there was no path shown to me as a kid, you know. There was my parents weren't religious Jews. They were just, you know, they were assimilated. They had no idea themselves of any spiritual path. They were good people, but they couldn't share that with me because they didn't have it. So it wasn't until later that I came across Buddhism and Hinduism and Sufism and mystic Christianity and things like that. And mystic Judaism too, like the Baal Shem Tov. That type of thing, you know, that I understood there really was a path, an inner path to finding oneself and one's true self.
Well, I grew up Jewish too, KD, in Hebrew school twice a week, some years three times a week, and then bas mitzvah, and I felt incomplete. I felt like I was given a culture, but I wasn't given a way in as well.
Mm-hmm.
Never heard about the Kabbalah. If I did, it wasn't something stressed enough. I remember Israel, and I remember Israel. And the importance of Israel.
You know, that's because our parents were survivors of the Holocaust. You know, they were the ones who were born from the survivors who didn't get murdered by the Nazis. And so the most important thing for them was surviving, living a good life, and being grateful for just being alive. And that's kind of where the beginning and end of their lives, you know, that's what was important to them, because one generation before, you know, was 90% slaughtered. So the reaction to that is to just get along and to survive as best you can. Then our generation, you know, we that wasn't enough for most of us. We wanted to find something deeper.
So well, I read something in Tricycle where 70% of American Buddhists are Jews.
Mm-hmm.
Sharon Salzberg, who you do a lot of workshops for Omega with.
Sure.
She isn't that Salzberg. Isn't she from a Jewish heritage?
I believe so, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sharon's great. We do a lot of workshops together. We enjoy each other's company so much, you know. And she, I think people have the wrong understanding or image of meditation.
I'm with you.
Most people think meditation is sitting down and fighting with your mind.
Mm-hmm.
And just trying to concentrate. And it's a losing battle, really, on that level. But, the way Sharon teaches, she teaches mostly a practice called metta, M-E-T-T-A, meditation, which is loving-kindness meditation. And it involves cultivating new ways of thinking about life, new ways of thinking about yourself. It's not sitting down and battling with your thoughts, but it's a way of developing a whole new way of being in the world. It's such a wonderful practice. And that practice, along with chanting, is very powerful because chanting also brings us into a deeper space in our lives, you know, where our thoughts and emotions don't drive us completely mad all the time.
It's kind of hard when you're sitting there doing call and response with the kirtan to be in thought.
Yeah, the thing is, you just... That's why they call it a spiritual practice. It brings you into the moment. And that stuff may still be going on. You know, it's not our job to kill it or to push it away. It's just our job to sing. So while we're chanting, those thoughts might come, those emotions might come, but we keep the chant going. And just being able to do that while all those thoughts and emotions are passing through us, that's what trains us to find a way to live in the world where we're not at the mercy of those, all those negative emotions.
Yeah, I found myself comparing. I don't know if you remember, I even said something about that, the kirtan with you to meditation, where I train my students to come off of a thought and come back to the breath. And with the kirtan, it's...
Mm-hmm. It's very similar, very similar. But the kirtan involves the chanting what they call in India the names of God, these mantras or these sounds that invoke a deeper place within us.
Yeah.
And so it's not just coming back to the breath, for instance, which is a very powerful practice. And for some people that works better. But it also involves this chanting and making these sounds, and this music that opens us up in another way also at the same time.
Completely. I found my body, my heart, my shifted. Like I felt more life force tingling up, down, and around through my system. I found myself really with more energy from the kirtan. I do the same thing with meditation, but it wasn't tingling from meditation the way it did from the kirtan. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. It's just absolutely extraordinary. I felt like my nervous system was flushing more energy up and down it.
Mm-hmm.
I remember seeing Sting in concert when he was standing on his heels, kind of like in mountain pose, and bouncing up and down and it seemed like he was letting the energy just build. He didn't move. He just stood there playing his guitar and singing and bouncing up and down on his heels. And yeah, it reminded me of like the building of energy that I experienced with doing kirtan with you. I mean, Deva Pramala is absolutely beautiful. You've done work with Deva Pramala Mitten, right?
Sure, with Deva and Mitten, they're good friends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's like the female voice of you, but you're like the pioneer. Am I inappropriately crediting you, KD? Because I consider you the pioneer of bringing kirtan to the West.
I guess I don't know if I mean I really don't know. I think they're calling me all kinds of things. The old man of kirtan.
They're calling me all kinds. I'm sure they are.
the old crotchety old man of kirtan. They're calling me all kinds of stuff, but. You know, I guess nobody, for some reason, what I did became, what I do speaks to people in a certain kind of way that makes it easy for them to get into it and to kind of get an experience of what it's about.
Krishnadas, you were saying how you think people have these perceptions and misunderstandings about meditation, and I find that all the time with helping American adults wrap their brains around what meditation is not, more so than what it is. And I was wondering, in the workshops, for example, like that you do with Sharon Salzberg, what are you finding in the most recent years, as like in the last year or so, that people are really in America challenged with in the mind? I mean, I know it's in some ways no different than centuries ago, but at the same time, it seems like there's particular catching points more so.
Well, actually, I think present day times are quality of inner life is much worse than at any time in the past, except maybe during some of the major world wars. But because now we have there's so much money, you know, the financial troubles and the economy's bad, the terrorism around the world, the government's falling. There's an extraordinary amount of anxiety that people are living with and fear. Almost, and because of the internet, you know, somebody shoots somebody in a little town around the world, in another corner of the world, and you know about it. So there's a much greater awareness of the state of the world than ever before. And the problem is that our inner peace is destroyed by all this news. And because we don't know and really have never been living in a deep sense of who we are, it really affects our lives on so many levels. Our health, our states of mind, really, it's very, very difficult times for people. So meditation really can simply be summed up as a way to finding a way to live every day without the fear and the anxiety that overpowers us so often.
And I found that feeling of overpowering when a thought has the ability to get to that level of overpowering. There's emotional charge behind it because there's some belief behind that thought. Like, it's not just a simple thought, like, I'm going to go to the movies tomorrow or not. But it's a thought like, oh God, he might leave me. And then all of the attachment to what change would be like to go through if he left, and all the identity wrapped around it. Like, there's all the belief and thoughts and life force and fear wrapped around the ones that can take us away. I call them runaway fears. What do you think about how kirtan can help people? If they're a person who feels like they've concluded that they can't meditate, is that part of the reason why kirtan has increased? I mean, because it's really picked up.
I think so, because it works. It's so easy. And everybody, most people like to sing and make music, and so this is a practice about that includes that, and so that when people come to do it, they get an immediate response in their own hearts, in their own beings. So you can think about this stuff, you can argue about this stuff, but the bottom line is, once you taste something, then you know what it is. And the people who come to sing, most of them leave having tasted something that they might or might not have expected. And that's, you don't need to be told by anybody what it is. You yourself know, because you just tasted it yourself. And then if it's a pleasant taste, if it's helped you, then you naturally want to go back there and do it again. And that's the beginning of really, learning to listen to our inner hearts, listen to ourselves, and learn to find a way to live in the world in a good way.
How is that when we have that feeling of that results from singing kirtan? How does that help us feel our inner hearts?
Well, because because for the period of time that you're singing, all the things that usually pull us out of ourselves and cause us tension and anxiety become something that they're moved to the background naturally by the practice of chanting and being in a room full of people that are chanting. Because everybody has their own storyline. But for that period, while we're all singing together, all our storylines kind of recede to the background. And as soon as they come up to us again and we start worrying about, oh, I forgot to get the car fixed and I left something cooking on the stove, you know. As soon as all that stuff comes up, it's pushed back to the background by the chanting. Or it's allowed to recede again rather than push back. And then we experience a release from that part of our lives that so struggles all the time. And you just, it feels good. It feels, nobody has to tell you that you've been let out of a room, you know?
Yeah, so what you're saying, when you use the words, we can feel our inner hearts, what you mean is what you just described by the mind and its activity being able to recede into the background. And in a community of people who are all chanting these words that are connected to an energy of a form of the more sacred parts of life, mm-hmm. then we're able to almost bypass the heart and connect in with another source of power because the mind has quieted. Yeah. I find that
it's only modern Western religion that's taken sacred and moved it someplace far away.
Yeah.
The Eastern religions, which go back tens of thousands of years, some of them, Buddhism goes back 2,500 years, mystic Christianity goes back, 2,000. The sacred is within us. It's not outside of us. It's not something else. It's not somewhere else. You know, it's within us. And it's who we really are. It's not something else. But it's all covered up by our stuff. By the culture. By the cultural stuff. And so if we uncover, all we have to do is uncover it. And that's what things like chanting do, practices like chanting. They uncover what we really are, the beauty, the love, the peace, the joy, the strength, the wisdom, and the goodness that we really are.
Yeah. Without the talk therapy, the psychoanalysis, and digging into the shadow, it's just do it and be it, feel it.
But actually, to tell you the truth, I think that it can be very useful to start to look at those shadow things, you know, with therapy or counseling and stuff like that. But the ability to let go and to release the grip of those things, that ability is strengthened to an nth degree by a spiritual practice.
That's
because without a spiritual practice, you're just pushing things around on the same level that you are. But with a practice, it's like dropping an anchor down into the ocean. The ship, the winds are going to continue to blow, but the ship is not going to get blown around the way it used to. And the winds will just pass by and without grabbing you and pushing you around the way they used to do.
With the practice of a spiritual practice, you've said, having a spiritual practice gives us leverage over the other parts of our lives that grip at us, that cause the anxiety and cause the fear and cause the worry and all of that, that flips our biochemistry into stress-related diseases and into being closed down. And having forcing ourselves to do a disciplinary practice that opens us up to the other, what I call power centers. In Chinese theory, there's other power centers. The mind isn't considered one. The heart is, the low abdomen, which is considered like the will force. These other places are a more divinely connected will force. And then our hearts, these are considered Dantian's power centers. And I know when I teach my yoga classes, doing the warrior poses, for example, to help people open up to their hearts, and talking about after meditating and moving into the sequence of the poses, that it's not just our minds, although we're taught to get the degrees and use our intellectual power to move forward and make gains on the physical plane in our culture, and get somewhere with the degrees and get somewhere with the power of the mind, but we've gone into overdrive and coming back at it with the power of the connection to our higher self or something bigger, connection to our heart, and through connecting to our heart, connected to that higher self, or through meditation, allowing a connection to come through, or through kirtan. I mean, there's all these different tools that are available to help give more muscle, if you will, to our, something other than our mind that's going to bring us more peace.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely.
It hurts sometimes being here in America. It hurts my heart. When you come here from India, do you have that same...
Well, I find this, everybody suffers in their own way everywhere in the world. That's what this world is.
Indeed.
That's the nature of this world. You know, everybody, there's suffering everywhere. And it's just slightly different. You know, in the East, inside, basically, they feel okay about themselves. But the roads are screwed up and nothing works. Here in the West, the roads work perfectly. Everything's fine. We have 90,000 channels on television. We have broadband internet. But inside, we're all screwed up and not happy. So we have our own, each culture has their own suffering.
Thank you for bringing me back to that. We're talking about using other systems in our human system than our mind so that we can have a more balanced, comfortable existence. And I was saying how sometimes it hurts my heart to be here in America. And I have to say that, let me contextualize that, so hopefully, I know some people may take some offense hearing that, but it makes my heart really warm in some ways. But in other ways, just seeing the anxiety levels and the amount of coming from the mind, we are in a paradigm that sets us up to be on the surface of life and to focus outside of ourselves from our religions and our science. And we've lost something in that. And so it feels like and seems like we're in the days of a spiritual awakening, particularly in America. And there's so many people seeking now for connection to something beyond their mind, higher than their mind, more sacred than their mind, more eternal. And I feel like because we're such a fresh new country, comparatively, we don't have this historical context that gives us meaning and a way to interpret the events of our lives with some sense of meaning and context and higher purpose. And it just leaves us really spinning on the surface of life. So it hurts my heart sometimes because I feel the shutdown when we're living from our minds and engaged in a lot of the digital technology and the TVs and the entertainment and what am I going to do next and where am I going to go next and the going on the surface without much connection to the inner self and the sacred. That's the race. And my heart hurts sometimes because there's so much more to connect with, to empower our lives and to open up to and to bring into our lives. And that's what we're talking about here. I know, KD, you talk about your path with self-acceptance and that being part of the shadow for you. And I know that I work with that in my practice with my clients. I mean, it's not that we don't work with the shadows, but it seems like we come to a certain point where we just drive forth storylines instead of giving ourselves some kind of muscle, like we lift weights to train a bicep. Any kind of spiritual practice, whether it's a regular yoga practice or meditation or kirtan or sitting down with ourselves for 10 minutes a day and talking to our self-talk. Like, well, so why do you think you don't deserve to have that new job? Like, just addressing, instead of running, addressing what is happening inside. That's all I'm talking about. So, Kate, you want to share?
Well, yeah, you know, I think the idea is that inside of us, we're really okay. But the way we live and the way we've been brought up and the general atmosphere of Western culture at this time is all outer directed, and we never get a chance to slow down and look within and find the peace within. So when we talk about the shadow and when I started to deal with some of the destructive tendencies I had, my understanding was if I could just release this and didn't allow myself to get so hurt by my own stuff, then everything would be okay. It's not like I needed something else from someone else in order to do that. But my understanding was I just had to release these negative ways of thinking about myself and that kind of stuff, and then everything would be fine. And so it gives you a real context for working in, and a very clear understanding of the direction we're going. The only thing that troubles us is our own thoughts and emotions, which arise in reaction to things that happen in the world. And difficult stuff happens to everybody. And the question is, does it destroy us and ruin our lives forever? Or can we discover a way to live with even the most difficult of situations that happen, like the death of a loved one or a child, something that's really, or sickness and disease ourselves? We can find that inner strength to be able to, regardless of what's happening in the body or in the outside world, be happy. That's a possibility. It's not just a possibility, but it's a necessity.
Oh, beautifully said, Krishna Das. Why is it a necessity to be happy in the body?
Excuse me?
Why is it a necessity to be happy in the body?
Why is it a necessity?
To be happy in our bodies.
Because that's who we are. There is within each one of us a natural sense of well-being, just because it's there.
Beautifully said.
Yeah, so we don't need any reason to be happy. To have this feeling of well-being, this exists within us, but it's covered up by our thoughts, by our emotion, and by our negative unconscious beliefs about ourselves. And when we remove those illusions, those beliefs, then what we're left with is our who we really are, and there's nothing wrong with that.
I want to shift gears a little bit because I'd love for you to share the story of your first time witnessing kirtan in India, please.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, we had gotten to India, and now we spent some time on the plains, a couple of weeks, and then we went up to the mountains and we met Maharaji for the first time, and he sent us to stay in a nearby town at the little hotel owned by some devotees of his. And so one night, it's a beautiful town, and it's high up in the mountains, and there's a beautiful crater lake there in the town. And so I was walking around the lake one night, and I walked by an ancient goddess temple, an ancient Devi temple, and there was chanting coming from inside, and I just literally could not move, you know. I couldn't move. I was mesmerized. And then somebody walked right by me and into the temple and kind of motioned for me to come in with him. So I went in, and that was it. You know, from that moment on, I knew that chanting was for me. There was just, this is what I wanted. I wanted to do this at every and any possibility that I could. And
after that, I just
ran around trying to find chanting everywhere.
Why? What was it that you were witnessing? Is this the time with the women in the back room?
No. This was a different time. This was probably a couple of years before that, actually.
Oh.
What you're talking about was during Durga Puja in Kenchi in the temple, and I was now living in the temple with my guru, and during the 10-day worship of the goddess in the fall called Durga Puja, many of the women from the local towns would come to spend that time in the temple, hanging out and doing seva, you know, making food and taking care of people. And also at night they would get together and they would chant, do these chants, because, you know, this is what people did in India in those days. And in the old days, and especially in the mountains, which was slightly less in the c- contemporary, mm-hmm. you know, times, because it's further away from the main towns, the main big cities. So they would get together and they would sing. That's what villagers did. That's their entertainment. There was no TV. There was radio, but you know, this is what they did traditionally for enjoyment, was these chants. So all the Maas would get together and they would start chanting, and it was just, talk about juice. It was unbelievable. So I would sit just outside the window and just listen to them for hours and hours and hours. And that's really, that was really powerful in terms of showing me what was possible with chanting. I mean, they were just wailing. They were so in it. The ability to give yourself 100% to something is very rare, but that's what is required eventually. And these women were just, there was no holding back. And that was just really extraordinary.
Okay, on that note, tomorrow I'm doing a workshop at Wendy Fit Yoga locally at 1:30 to 3:30 about the female goddesses, the fire goddesses like Kali and like Durga that KT was just talking about. Today is Green Tara Day, one of the main goddesses along with Guan Yin of Buddhism. Seems completely appropriate that we've had Krishna Das blessing us today. So much gratitude and many blessings, KT. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for joining us and allowing yourself this time to expand and become more of who you're here to be. Dr. K has a range of different offerings of her vibrational upgrades at all price points, including free. So for more information, please go to www.alisonjk.com. Dr. K's first book, What If There's Nothing Wrong, is available on Amazon.com. Dr. K also has a weekly clearing and activation call that is attended by her most advanced clients and students, an important activity in keeping themselves aligned and their vibration high. We'd love to have you come and play. Om Shanti.